The Church of God the Eternal presents the first message in a new series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 23rd, 2023.
I'm actually going to start a new series today, and I don't know how many sermons are going to be in it, but I'm going to count on it, minimum of 10. Could be a lot more depending on what I do with it as God inspires me where to go with it. You see, God has a domain in which he lives, and man also has a domain in which he lives. And so I want to pose the question, what does the Bible say about these places that we live, quote unquote? And what is the relevance for God's people today? So the Bible has a lot to say about places to dwell, to live, and we probably haven't focused upon it. I know I haven't, but I think there are some interesting aspects that we can derive. Again, nothing new, nothing, you know, no eureka moments, except that I believe that there are a lot of texts in the Bible and principles that when we put a spotlight on them in a certain way, it's going to give you an additional dimension to understanding some things and hopefully an enriching experience for you from some of these principles. So we're going to talk a lot about places that we live, habitations. And in fact, I'm focusing on the word habitat. Because a habitation, the Bible certainly, as in the King James translation, uses the word habitation, inhabitants. And so we're going to look at those in particular and then expand from there and see what we can learn about it. What are the physical and spiritual aspects of these habitations? Or I will just call it a habitat. Now, we're used in the English, at least Americans use the word habitat, and you think more like animals. Like, the apes of Congo and their natural habitat. And if I give you I'll give you a clinical or a dictionary definition of the word habitat. It includes that, but it is more expansive, and so I'm using that word for a reason. But the word habitat, one definition is a place or environment where a plant or animal naturally or normally lives and grows. And so that's the one you think about, the animal kingdom, you know, a habitat in the forest or in the sea or whatever it may be. But the word habitat also can be defined this way, the typical place of residence of a person or a group. So it doesn't apply just to plants and animals, it applies to people as well. Another definition is this, a housing for a controlled physical environment in which people can live under surrounding inhospitable conditions. And Merriam-Webster Dictionary gives an example as under the sea. So there you would think about a habitat for human beings that has to be artificial in that case, right? Because in order for human beings to exist under the sea, then they would have to have some means to support life, because otherwise they wouldn't live there. So there's an artificial habitat, if you will. And you're aware with that term used in a lot of applications around us today. Another definition is a habitat is a place where something is commonly found. So it can be that general. Habitat is just where you find something. What does the Bible have to say about it? We're going to take a number of Bible texts just to give you an introduction today about this whole idea about a place to live, a dwelling, a domain, a domicile, i.e. a habitat. Let's start in Leviticus 18 and verse 25. I'm doing a little bit of word study, but not really. I don't want to make this just a technical review of Hebrew and Greek words as much as overriding principles, which I think will be valuable for you. But here in Leviticus 18:25, we read, "The land is defiled," God says, "therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants." So here's the English translation, inhabitants. It's the Hebrew word yashab, Y-A-S-H-A-B, which literally means to sit down, to dwell, to remain, to settle, and to abide. So I would tell you the more appropriate translation for the context of what God is talking about here, where he says, I visit the iniquity thereof upon it, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. So in this case, we've got two concepts. We've got inhabitants, which are people who live, they dwell someplace, they abide. So I think dwell and abide are probably the best translations into English. And the antecedent is the land. So where's the habitat? The inhabitants, and it's part of the same word in English, isn't it? We got habitat, but we've got inhabitants. So we use that word all the time. So think about the English words we have. Inhabitants do what? They inhabit what? A place of habitation, i.e. a habitat. Okay, and what's the other element of the English word which is very appropriate? Included in there is another English word, habit. No, I didn't do a big study in the origin of the Old English, but I'm very willing to bet that there's a reason that the word habit is in there. Because when you're talking about a dwelling place, a home, a domicile, you are talking about a place that you go habitually, right? It's a common place you keep going back to. So I think that is absolutely legitimately caught up in the concept, which is why this word also includes the translation to sit down. It's a place where you go and stay. Dwell is where you remain. That's another technical definition of the word. It's where you settle. It's where you abide. And so the word habit certainly seems to apply, doesn't it? You make a habit of going back to a particular place over and over again. And isn't that what you and I do when we go home, whatever you consider home? There's a habit involved in it, right? A familiarity. That's where you live. That's where you dwell. That's your domain. That's your domicile. That's your crib. That is where you live. It is your habitat in whatever way. And so here God is referring to the land, in essence, as the dwelling place, and then the inhabitants, the ones who have made a habit out of being there, and yet he says he's going to kick them out, which is exactly what he did with the people of the land of Canaan. And then later he did it to the Israelites. Let's look at some more. Leviticus 25 and verse 10. Leviticus 25 and verse 10. Here we find, "Ye shall hallow the 50th year," because we're talking about Jubilee, "and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." So now this is in the promised land given to Israelites, that which was taken away from the previous inhabitants, and now God establishing all the rules for the Israelites in their place of dwelling. "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you. You shall return every man into his possession. You shall return every man into his family." So I'm focusing again on the fact that you've got inhabitants, which are people who live, dwell, remain, settle, abide someplace. And where? Where are they? What is the antecedent here? Again, it's the land in this particular case. Is every reference in the Bible to a place of living, dwelling, remaining always land? No, not at all. We're going to look at a lot of different potential habitats or domains. But just to get us started here, let's look at Numbers 33. Numbers 33, beginning in verse 51. Numbers 33:51, speaking to the children of Israel and saying to them, when you are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land. Okay, same theme going here, inhabitants of the land. From before you, and destroy all their pictures, and destroy all their molten images, and quite pluck down all their high places. Verse 53, and you shall dispossess the inhabitants. So there's somebody who was dwelling, abiding, remaining, settling, sitting down. They possessed it as their own, and yet God says he's going to dispossess them. You shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell therein, for God says, I have given you the land to possess it. Emphasizing what you and I already know, God is the one that owns everything that exists, and he gives it to whoever he wants. And it's a common theme you see being repeated today in our nations. And I've even just in the last week seen more of these principles being highlighted in the news concerning these individuals, influential individuals with an agenda to try to make modern day Israelites, they don't know that they're Israelites, but they are, to feel ashamed about possessing the land that they have now, including this country where we are right now. And you're considered an interloper. You're a European, a white European. You don't belong here. And so now they're using these terms, decolonization. Decolonization. So they're applying it to the Israelis over in the Middle East and Palestine, using their phrases, which you're hearing a lot about this, either, you know, with the Palestinians or the Israelis, from the river to the sea. You know, Palestine shall be free. And what does that mean? That means basically push the Israelis into the ocean. Get them completely out of the land because they have no right to it. And they've got the same philosophy going on in our nations as well. So we don't have a right to be here. So they want to decolonize North America. And all the European interlopers for the last hundreds of years need to get out so that the indigenous people can have the right rightful return of it. If you don't see where civil war and the conflicts that God prophesied concerning events of the last days before the return of Christ are coming from, we are seeing a lot of them. But here's this philosophy that I believe is going to be integral to this pushing and shoving between these factions, and they're both absolutely committed to their cause. So I guarantee you, people are going to stake their claim, and many of them are going to be willing to die for it, which is why you're going to see more deaths and more persecution and tribulation in the final days than has ever existed on the face of the earth, so said Jesus Christ in Matthew 24. The only question is what's going to lead to it. But these philosophies are probably integral. And one of the things that always raises its head, who has the right to a domain? Oh, people will fight over who has the right to the land, who has a right to a property. And people will defend their perceived domain, either right or wrong. And so those factors are coming into play. They do not accept at all what God said here to Israel when he said, I'm the one who owns it, and I chose to give this land to Israel. I don't care how many hundreds or thousands of years the previous people actually possessed it, you know, remained there, dwelled there, sat down on it, settled there. They were still by God considered temporary occupants, interlopers, until the day it was his determination to turn it physically over to its rightful inhabitants, which were the Israelites. Oh, but don't espouse that today. I guarantee you Satan's world today hates the idea. And anybody who wants to even talk about it like I'm doing now is going to be hated for it. However, that does not make it untrue. It is true, because the invisible God is the one who determines the bounds of all of these habitations. I'm getting ahead of myself because I don't want to get into all of that today concerning the habitations on the earth. I'm really just trying to set the stage for the idea in general of a domain, of a habitat. and all the possible places that encompass this idea, both for God and man. We're going to talk a little bit more about the habitation of God today and ultimately get to the habitations of human beings. But to get the idea in your mind, he says, I have given you the land to possess it. Numbers 35 and verse 33. Numbers 35 and verse 33, so you shall not pollute the land wherein you are, for blood is it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed by the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. In other words, so God is just reconfirming to the Israelites an element of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, that part of his principle is that if you violate laws, there has to be recompense. And any capital crime had to be paid for, compensated for by more blood, the death of the perpetrator, which obviously then leads to our salvation through Jesus Christ, because ultimately then through his death, having been innocent, now our death penalty, instead of having to shed our blood for our sins, we can be redeemed because he paid that price for us through his shed blood. But the principle, you know, in a raw fashion is stated here. For blood, it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein. You can't go through some mumbo jumbo procedure or whatever, a ritual that actually takes away the guilt. But by the blood of him that shed it, there has to be a payment from the guilty party. So said God. Verse 34, defile not therefore the land which you shall inhabit. So again, we're talking about land as the habitat here. And then you've got the ones who live on the land who are the inhabitants. But notice this additional element here. Defile not therefore the land which you shall inhabit wherein I dwell. Isn't that interesting? So the Israelites dwell there, but God said he also lives there. Isn't that interesting? Wherein I dwell, for I, the Eternal, dwell among the children of Israel. Where is God's place of living, of dwelling? Where is his domain? With Israel. Is that the only place that God lives? Well, of course not. We're going to see a lot of that as well today. Psalm 33, verse 8. Psalm 33, verse 8. Here we read, let all the earth fear the Eternal. Now, what's the subset of humanity? Well, it's not even a subset. It's the entire human family, which is the target, not just one nationality or group of people. Let all the earth fear the Eternal. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. Now, what's the object of the living or the dwelling or the remaining or the staying? The entire world. And who are the inhabitants referred to? It's all human beings upon this earth. So the habitat in this case is the earth, and all peoples upon it are the inhabitants. So let's now ask the question, does God have a habitat? Well, we just read the one that said he dwells with Israel in the land with them. But it's bigger than that, isn't it? Of course. And we all understand this. I don't know how much I'm going to get into going through. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. I haven't even factored it all into my outline concerning, you know, heaven in what we call the third heaven as for the throne of God. I'll probably go through it and cover it. But these are part of the 101 fundamentals that all Church of God people understand, who were taught in this way. But notice Psalm 33, verse 13. Verse 13 tells us, the Eternal looks from heaven and beholdeth all the sons of men. Verse 14, from the place of his habitation. And where is that? From the place of his habitation, he looks upon all the inhabitants of the earth. So here now we're talking about a place that God lives and dwells, which is not the earth. Because it says specifically that for all the people who do live on the earth, he's seeing it from a distance. From the place of his habitation, wherever that is, he looks upon all the inhabitants of the earth. So this case is talking about God living, dwelling, inhabiting someplace apart from the earth upon which you and I live. And we understand that because he dwells in the heavens. Where? Just where his throne is, and we can turn to all of those texts that describe the throne of God, especially in the book of Revelation. That revelation that John was allowed to see and describe through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit and all the activity that takes place with the worshiping of the angels and the physical description of all of that, that's a habitat. No doubt about it. Is that the only place God lives? Is that the only place he dwells? Not at all. Psalm 68, verse 4 and 5. Psalm 68, beginning in verse 4, sing unto God, sing praises to his name, extol him that rideth upon the heavens. Well, here he's not living on it, but he's riding on it like a horse, I guess. But what we're seeing here by just a number of these texts is the breadth of the domain of God. Whether it symbolically shows him as living, dwelling there, possessing it, using it, like transportation, whatever. But here, in symbolic parlance, it says, extol him that rides upon the heavens by his name Yah, and rejoice before him. Verse 5, a father of the fatherless and a judge of the widows is God in his holy habitation. So here we find out that God has a habitation, not just a habitation, but a holy habitation. This is a different Hebrew word, by the way. The word, I don't know if I pronounce it correctly, maon, M-A-O-W-N. This one specifically means a home, a lair, a retreat, a den, and a dwelling place. So similar to some of the other words we've been looking at, but more specific of being a home, a den, a dwelling place. And so this is really saying God in his holy retreat, home, or dwelling place. So he has a habitation, a place that he lives and dwells, and it is holy. I guarantee you that any place that God is holy. We already know that by a number of texts in the Bible. But again, I'm just trying to hit the high points for this afternoon. Let's also look at Psalm 89. We're answering the question, does God have a habitat? I think these texts certainly show that he does. Psalm 89, verse 13 and 14. Here we read, thou hast a mighty arm, strong is thy hand, and high is thy right hand. Justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. Now this is interesting. Just to get you used to this idea of evaluating every statement, you have an inhabitant and you have a habitat where you have a place where they live and you have a person who lives there. What are the two parts to that in this particular case? And it's symbolic and it's language poetic. And yet God inspired it just this way for a reason, and using this very concept of a place to dwell, to remain, to stay, to live, what do we find? Justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. Okay, who's the inhabitor? This might be a little harder to piece together, but it's like math, it's all there. In this case, the inhabitant is the throne. God is answering the question, where does his throne live? And what's the answer to the question? God's throne, he says here, lives in a place of justice and judgment. So that's very interesting, unusual, that the concept of justice and judgment is related to a dwelling place in this case. And we don't think about it that way, because justice and judgment are concepts. They're not physical, they're not material, and it's certainly not a place where you set up your camp. But for a reason, God actually calls it that. In other words, so he is treating philosophically the idea of a place where true justice and judgment reside, where they exist, is like a dwelling place. And he's saying the throne of God actually lives in this house of justice and judgment. Now that helps clarifies it any. I think it's interesting. Justice and judgment are the habitation. That's the dwelling place, justice and judgment. I'll call it the house of justice and judgment because that helps us get it better. A house of justice and judgment is where God's throne lives. And I think we get the meaning of that. Wherever you find God's throne, which is the center of power, which is what a throne demonstrates, the administration of government happens from a throne. And wherever you find the administration of God's government, it is going to be in a house which is filled with true justice and good judgment. Wouldn't you love to have that in the world right now? Where governments upon this earth fulfilled their responsibilities to the citizenry according to good judgment, righteousness. And of course, it's never going to happen as long as human beings rule, which is another reason why we pray for the coming of Jesus Christ to be king and high priest ruling over this earth. That's the only time this earth is going to become a habitation for the government of God. And you will see then the proliferation of true judgment, righteous judgment, and true justice. But not until then, which is why we pray, thy kingdom come. You're really, when you pray that, you are praying for the habitation of God upon this earth. What else do we find? Isaiah 40, verse 21. Isaiah 40, verses 21 and 22. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? So we're talking about building principles here because we're talking about the earth with a foundation. Verse 22, it is he that sits upon the circle of the earth. Interesting language. And the inhabitants thereof. So again, what's the habitat, the living environment that we're speaking of now? Again, it's the earth as a place to live. He that sits upon the circle of the earth and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in. A lot of interesting language there, and again, symbolic, poetic, in order to make a point to help our weak minds to see some of these vast concepts which are spiritual and invisible. Now, I think this is one of the ones that the flat earthers probably like to grab onto to try and claim that the earth is a flat circle as opposed to being a sphere. Can I say again, that's all nonsense, and anybody in the true Church of God who's getting caught up or involved in that, you need to get over that because it's also part of the lies of this world. The earth is a sphere, and it does orbit around the sun at the center of our solar system. So when I read this, I mean, there's multiple ways that this could be interpreted. But here, symbolically, it says God sits upon the circle of the earth. And so I think about it as the earth is actually making its annual revolution around the sun. And it's if God, with his power, actually rides the earth like a source of transportation. Again, he's everywhere and he can be anywhere he wants to. But this is another way to describe the power of God to do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, and to be wherever he wants. Whereas human beings like grasshoppers are dependent upon their little place on the surface of the earth, God rides the circle of the earth. That's the comparison that's being given to us to help us to understand the difference between the lofty heights of the power of God versus ourselves. The inhabitants thereof is as grasshoppers that stretch out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. There, the antecedent is the heavens. So we look up from our little spot like a grasshopper on the earth and we see all the stars and the planets in the sky. And God describes it as this: he has stretched out this big tent that allows us to see this canvas of light in the sky. Again, the flat earthers will tell you that's because, see, we live in this little dome and that really is a tent. Again, all nonsense. But poetically, God is showing he's the one that makes all this possible. He's in control of it. He created everything that exists. Which tells us, by comparison, our domain and our little habitat is quite meager, isn't it, compared to his? He goes wherever and does whatever he wants. He lives wherever he wants. He inhabits, as we're going to find out, all of eternity, besides the entire universe. And we are just little beings dependent upon our livelihood in a little spot on a planet in the middle of the solar system, in the middle of the universe. Our domains are quite different than that of God. Isaiah 57, verse 15. Isaiah 57, 15, for thus saith the high and lofty one, the high and lofty one that inhabits eternity. Here it is. So now this isn't just saying he inhabits the universe. Because we know, and one of the attributes of God that we learned, he's omniscient. And he's omnipresent, as well as omnipotent, all three of them, all-powerful, omnipotent, and omniscient means he has all knowledge, but omnipresent means he is everywhere. Not like the pagans believe that God is in everything. We're not talking about pantheism. We're talking about the power of the presence of this being we worship as the Creator God literally inhabits everywhere in the universe. And you can't wrap your mind around it, and neither can I. But that's why he's called the I Am. Because when Moses asked him, what should I say your name is? I am that I am. The same thing that Jesus Christ in the Gospels repeated when he said, I am. Which is another confirmation that he is everywhere. And that perfect, glorified state, there is no place you do not find God. He consumes the entirety of everything that exists. But this phrase is beyond just the idea that God is everywhere in the universe, the physical universe. Now we're introducing the concept of time, because that's what eternity does. Thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabits. Where does God live? Where does he dwell? Where does he stay? Where does he remain? Where is his crib? Eternity. And eternity is talking about time. Not only a physical place, somewhere at some distance or everywhere, in every distance in the universe, now we're talking about in all time dimensions, past, present, and future, God lives there. Now get your mind around that. That's where God lives. Not only everywhere that exists in this moment, quote, of time, but in every moment of any time. Because he's not subject to time, he created time. That's God's dwelling place. That's eternity. That's where God lives. The high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy, he says, I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit. Ah, oh, isn't it? No, wait. God's talking about his lofty position inhabiting not only the universe, but superseding the concept of time. And then he turns and he says he's sharing that state with lowly human beings. How is that possible? I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones, which is a prophecy concerning the birth of more beings into the God family to share that same lofty state. And that is coming. So he's not just existing there in that domain, that habitat, by himself, but the entire plan for our existence is because he wants to share that domain with every one of you. He's given you a right to that. You're not a usurper for wanting to be God. You were created in his image for the reason, for the purpose of being God. And if you are born into the God family, then you will also inhabit the domain of God, which will mean you will have all of these attributes of that spirit being, including omnipotence and omniscience and omnipresence. So then your habitat, your new domicile, your new domain is going to be the entire universe, and in fact is going to be eternity. You too will have no limit on the timeline anymore. How do you like that? Would you like to live there? Would you like that to be your new home? That, you see, is the domain, the habitat of God. Jeremiah 25, verse 30. Jeremiah 25, verse 30 says, "Therefore prophesy thou against them all these words, and say unto them, The Eternal shall roar from on high." That means from his lofty place in the heavens that we can't touch. "The Eternal shall roar from on high where he is, and utter his voice from his holy habitation," wherever this center of operation is. "He shall mightily roar upon his habitation. He shall give a shout that they that tread the grapes against all the inhabitants of the earth." So again, a comparison is being made between the habitat of God versus the habitat of human beings upon this earth. Because he's doing a work with the one from a position of the other. Two different places. So yes, I've given you the text to show that he says he dwells with his people. He dwells with them where they are, but he also says he lives in all these other places, depending on the aspect of what work of that God is being emphasized. You can't put any limit on him or his domain. Now, with that in, I'm just giving you a very quick smattering to get your mind hopefully geared to expanding, to recognize when we're talking about the habitat of God, you're talking about something wonderful and is beyond our minds to comprehend. As we compare that to the physical habitats on this earth and other places, then hopefully you're going to see the value in it. But notice Psalm 132, verse 1. Because here now we describe the problems that human beings have in digesting or recognizing to fathom this idea of where God lives. The habitat of God is described right here. Psalm 132, verse 1 through 5, a song of degrees. "The Eternal, remember David and all of his afflictions, how he sware unto the Eternal and vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob, surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house." That's David's domain, his dwelling, his domicile. "Nor go up into my bed. I will not give sleep to mine eyes or slumber to mine eyelids," verse 5, "until I find out a place for the Eternal, a habitation for the mighty God of Jacob." So we understood and do understand by all of this that David then got in his mind that he wanted to build a house for God. That's what all this is about. We're going to see that expanded. Let's go to 2 Samuel 7. And I'm going to read verses 1 all the way through verse 13 to give you the story. So we're talking about a house for God in the mind of David. And it was inspired. There was an inspiration from God to David. He wasn't just totally out in left field. And yet, what he understood, and as God allowed him to be motivated to have a desire to do this grand building project, but David didn't understand the purpose that God had for it. And I'm telling you that that is often the way it is, I think, for you and me as well. If you're led by God's Holy Spirit, he might be leading you to say it's okay to do something But you might not understand all the reasons why. He has a bigger plan that he's working out by allowing you to do or guiding you to do something than what he necessarily lets you in to see. So let's see it here in David's case, 2 Samuel 7, verse 1. Came to pass when the king sat in his house, his habitation, his dwelling place, and he was incredibly thankful to God for providing to him this habitation. Came to pass when the king sat in his house and the Eternal had given him rest round about from his enemies. And boy, that was a special status for David, who literally had had to fight all his life. He was involved in wars almost nonstop until this point in his life. He recognized it as a blessing, and then he wanted to do something constructive with it. So God gave him this beautiful home as king of Israel and gave him peace in his kingdom so he didn't have to spend all his time as a general. He could turn his attention to doing other constructive things within the bounds of Israel. And what did he want to do? Verse 2, that the king said unto Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, meaning a very expensive, comfortable abode was this house of cedar. I dwell, David said, in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within curtains. Because the Ark of the Covenant now was still dwelling within a tent in another city outside of Jerusalem. I dwell in a house of cedar, but the Ark of God dwells within curtains. And Nathan said to the king, go, do all that is in thine heart, for the Eternal is with thee. So here, David has this idea that he wants to build a house for God, a place for the Ark of the Covenant, the presence of God, to dwell. And he wanted to make it better than the house he was living in. He thought that only right. And here, by inspiration, God inspires Nathan to tell David, you're on the right path. You're not totally out in left field. Go with your program. But now it seems like what follows is a contradiction. Because in essence, God is telling Nathan, as we're going to find out, go and tell David he can't, you know, he's got it all wrong. Well, which is it? Does he have it all wrong? Or did God inspire Nathan to tell David, do what you want to do? Yeah, both are true. David had the right idea, but he was thinking about it from the wrong vantage point. And God was going to correct him on that, which is beneficial for you and me. Go, do all that is in thine heart, for the Lord is with thee. Verse 4, it came to pass that night that the word of the Eternal came unto Nathan, saying, verse 5, go and tell my servant David. Now David's going to get more of God's thinking about this building project before he gets way off on the wrong path. Go tell my servant David, thus saith the Eternal, shalt thou build me an house for me to dwell in? Because you see, it was very similar to the pagan ideology about why they build their temples. And they think about it in terms of a place for their gods to live and to dwell and to function and to operate. But very often they, you know, pagan religions really treat their gods, though invisible and spiritual and with superpowers, like human beings who need a physical place to dwell. So this is a very common human, carnal, pagan orientation to the idea of building a church or a temple, or a quote, habitation for God. And God is making sure that David does not get caught up in this false worldly ideology about a house of God. Verse 6, whereas I have not dwelt in any house since the time that I brought up the children of Israel out of Egypt, even to this day, but have walked in tents and as in tabernacles, and the inference is here, and I've been fine with that. God says, I don't need a physical place on this earth built by you. The center of the habitation of God, spiritually reflected by the existence of that Ark of the Covenant and that tabernacle that he had Moses built, and they carted for 40 years through the wilderness and then across the Jordan River and then into the Promised Land for generations, he's saying, I've been fine with that. I don't need some big grand house like pagan religions like to build for their quote-unquote gods. Verse 7, and all the places wherein I have walked with all the children of Israel, spake I a word. He's saying, did I ever tell you that I was unhappy because I didn't have a house? Spake I a word with any of the tribes of Israel whom I commanded to feed my people Israel, saying, why build ye not me a house of cedar? Have I ever said that I needed a house of cedar? David thought God needed a house of cedar because he had a house of cedar and he wanted to show respect for God. Good for David. But God is making it plain. I don't need a house of cedar. I don't need a domain, a dwelling place, a habitat like you. Verse 8, now therefore, God is still speaking to Nathan to take this message to David. Now therefore, so shalt thou say unto my servant David, thus saith the Eternal of hosts, I took thee from the sheepcote, from following the sheep, to be ruler over my people over Israel. God is reminding David, who is helping who? David was the youngest, lowliest son of seven, tending the sheep. And God is the one who miraculously pulled him out of that and promoted him through circumstances to become the king of Israel. So who has the power? God does. If God wanted a house on this earth, could he just make one? Could he create his own habitat? Yes. Does he need David to do something nice for God? Otherwise, God is somehow missing something? Absolutely not. And that's the point that's being made here. So God is telling Nathan, remind David, he's in the position that he's in now with the wealth and the power and the position because of what I did for him. I don't need anything from him in return. Verse 9, he says, I was with thee whithersoever thou wentest and have cut off all thine enemies out of thy sight and have made thee a great name, like unto the name of the great men that are in the earth. Verse 10, moreover, now here's what God is saying prospectively he's going to do in the future. Moreover, I will. Who's going to build a house? Who's going to do a work? David gets points for being motivated and sincere and wanting to do some grand scheme in honor of God. But God's reminding him, it's really not you, it's me. Moreover, I, he said, will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more as before time. So David's talking about building a big grand house for God, and God turns it around and says, no, you don't understand. I'm actually the one who's building a house for Israel and you. You think you're building a house for me? Let me set the record straight. The building project that's going to happen is all symbolic of a house that I'm building for you. Verse 11, and as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Eternal telleth thee that he will make thee a house. So David has this grand idea to use his time of peace and prosperity to build God a house, and God flips around and said, actually, what's going to happen is I'm going to build you a house. Not just David, but Israel. And not just physical Israel. This was actually a prophecy for the realm of Jesus Christ, the church, and that ultimate habitation for new sons in the glorified kingdom of God. Verse 12, and when thy days, he says, be fulfilled, meaning when David finally dies, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee. This is type and antitype, dual fulfillment. Solomon, yes, as the physical son who would become the king in replace of his father. But more so than that, as you and I understand, he says, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. So now we're still talking about a habitat, aren't we? We're talking about a domain. We're talking about a dwelling, a place to live, place from which your work proceeds, a kingdom. And yet here's a prophecy where God says through Nathan the prophet, I'm going to set up your son, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, that I will establish his kingdom. Verse 13, he shall build an house for my name. So in one part, David is clarifying, I know you want to build the house, a temple, but you're not going to be the one to do it. It's going to be your son Solomon. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Well, wait a minute. Solomon died too, so what are we talking about here? We're not just talking about Solomon. We're talking about something bigger. Yeah, we're talking about Jesus Christ as the ultimate descendant of David who was going to do this greater work. So the coming of Jesus Christ, who was a physical descendant of King David through Solomon, was going to do the real work of building a house. And that's the New Testament church. And by gift of the Holy Spirit, through baptism, after the death and qualification of Jesus Christ himself as our high priest and our Messiah as our Savior, then makes possible the building of the real house that matters, the ultimate domain that it's all about, and the habitat ultimately for an expanded God family. It's not about what's going on physically, temporarily on this earth at all. And so here David is thinking with very, very narrow blinders. Not wrong, because again, Nathan told him, do what you want to do because you're on the right track. God says, go for it. You're not proposing to do something wrong in any way. So go ahead. But then he clarifies through this dream, through the prophet Nathan, but clarify to David what he's really doing. He's not doing me a favor. And he's not just proposing to build a physical domain. And by the way, he's not going to get to see it constructed, because I'm actually going to allow it to be constructed by his son after he's dead. But I'm talking about something that's bigger than a physical building. We're talking about a kingdom and a habitat that is eternal. All of that is caught up in this prophecy. What did David understand? Very little. And yet what he was doing was a part of it, right? It was godly. But he had no clue the length and the breadth of this building project, the creation of this habitat, which God was preparing and executing. So what was the physical manifestation of it? David was allowed basically to put together all the building materials. He basically spent the rest of his life assembling all of the valuable elements for the temple, which was ultimately called Solomon's temple, by the way, not David's temple, because it was built in the lifetime of Solomon. But his father David was the one who literally put together all the building supplies and had them in inventory, ready for Solomon to actually bring about the actual construction of the building. So David had an important part in it. He sure did. He was a part of a very godly enterprise, and the building of that physical building called Solomon's temple was key. But it wasn't the preeminent consideration, because God allowed it to be destroyed, and then they rebuilt it and he allowed that to be destroyed. God emphasizing then what domain is really important. Human beings always glorify in the physical, even as the disciples of Jesus Christ, you know, thought they were going to show him the temple. In the beginning of Matthew 24, look at this great building. Isn't it awe-inspiring? And then Jesus, who was the buzzkill, in essence, said, the day's coming when there's not even one stone is going to be left one upon the other, what you're looking at in awe. So there's a greater aspect to everything that God is doing in the kingdom of men concerning a habitat, a domain, a dwelling place, a home. Yes, so Solomon confirmed also where God lives, where is the habitat of God is distinguished from a physical domain, even in a temple. Let's notice 1 Kings 8, 26. 1 Kings 8, verse 26. And now, O God of Israel, let thy word, I pray thee, be verified, which thou spake unto thy servant David, my father, Solomon speaking. Verse 27, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Solomon is being inspired now to understand this real distinction between God and man. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee. Solomon's mind couldn't even fathom it, but he was inspired to speak it. You're talking about a spiritual being that holds all power in heaven and earth. And he cannot be contained in a particular home or dwelling place or habitat. He consumes it all. Behold, the heaven and heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house that I have builded. So in Solomon's humility at this time in his life, he literally then put together the physical mechanics with God's help to make probably the most fabulous physical building which has ever existed upon this earth. And that has also been masked and hidden by Satan the devil, so that the history of it has been obscured. And what we have left are things like the Egyptian pyramids, you know, the Taj Mahal, and all these other buildings, which human beings, you know, they stand agape. Oh, how fabulous this is. And I suspect Solomon's temple was probably the most fabulous building that was ever constructed on this earth. The second temple that replaced it after the Israelites came back out of captivity was not as grand by it was still a grand building. The one that existed and was expanded even by King Herod in the days of Jesus Christ when he walked on the earth was a fabulous building which got worldwide acclaim, but it still did not hold a candle to the original built by Solomon. And yet Solomon, in his humility, understood he did not get carried away completely at this time in his life by the idea of the physical and the grandeur of the physical building that he had been instrumental in bringing into being. How much less this house that I have builded? He says, I am not mistaken in thinking that this grand building, which is so awe-inspiring to human beings, is actually a limiting house for God to live in. Because God can't be limited to any physical domain, no matter how grand it appears to us. Good for Solomon. Drop down to verse 42. For they shall hear of thy great name and of thy strong hand and of thy stretched out arm when he shall come and pray toward this house, meaning that temple. Why would anybody pray toward a physical building? Only because God was there. You pray to God, you don't pray to an idol. And human beings will make an idol out of everything and anything. And so there are people even who have come through and learned the truth through the true church of God who have turned to this kind of thing, which the Muslims do. They think they have to pray toward Mecca. That's their equivalent to this. So they always pray only facing Mecca, so they have to know their directions wherever they are around the world. I've been in hotels, literally, because I know what I'm looking for, and either up in the corner of the ceiling will be a green arrow that points, so that someone who's staying there knows which direction Mecca is. Sometimes I found it actually in a drawer in a hotel room. A desk drawer, you open the drawer, and there's a green arrow glued in the bottom of the drawer, which also points to Mecca, because it's important to them to know which, you know, they have to be facing that temple and that city. And there are people who have taken some of these statements like this to think, well, we should be praying toward Jerusalem, toward the site of the temple. Well, you tell me, is God there now over in Palestine? Is that where you think God is? And so you're going to pray in that direction? Number one, there's no physical temple there of God. And even in the days of Jesus Christ, when the temple still existed, guess what? It was being administered by Israelites who were apostate, which means God wasn't there. And the Son of God, Jesus Christ, was telling them they were vipers and hypocrites. So we need to understand the reality We pray to God. God is everywhere. It doesn't matter which direction you're pointing with your head, on your knees. You're praying to God who administers his government from his throne in heaven, but he consumes every place and everywhere in the universe. So don't get caught up in the superstitions of the pagans. But the concept here is, yes, praying toward the temple only because the assumption was that God was inside that temple, and therefore you prayed toward God, and that's where he would be. Come and pray toward the house, verse 43, hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place. So Solomon understood he wasn't confined now to a physical building. He acknowledged that heaven is the dwelling place of God. And do according to all that the stranger called to thee for, that all people on the earth may know thy name, to fear thee, to do thy as do thy people Israel, and that they may know that this house which I have builded, said Solomon, is called by thy name. So he acknowledged it had a holy purpose. It is called the house of God. But Solomon made sure to clarify, and it was recorded by the inspiration of God, that he wasn't saying he was trying to limit God to his domain in that temple, because no temple on earth can hold God. His domain is the entire universe, and as we've already seen, even eternity. Isaiah 66, verse 1 and 2. Isaiah 66, verse 1, thus saith the Eternal, the heaven is my throne. God speaking, the heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. If you want to talk about, you know, where, I guess God doesn't have a man cave, he has a God cave, you know. It's his den, it's his retreat, it's his place where he lives, he operates, he functions, he dwells. And in it, I guess if he has a footstool and he has a throne, and here symbolically he's describing the proper relationship between the two. He sits on a throne that's described in heaven, and the earth is his footstool. The heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you build unto me? How are you going to build me a house, God says? When the planet you live on is what I put my feet on. And where is the place of my rest? For all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Eternal, but to this man will I look. So he's not looking to a human being who gets sideways from the reality of who God is in relationship to mankind. But to this man will I look, even to him that is of poor and a contrite spirit and trembleth at my word. So Solomon described that and had that orientation of mind at the time that God used him to build the temple. Matthew 5, verse 34, because Jesus Christ repeats this same concept. Matthew 5, verse 34, Christ speaking, but I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. So those are all the property of God. And Jesus Christ is saying, don't swear by anything that belongs to me and not you. You have nothing to do with it. You have no power over it. Acts 7, verse 44. Here, in this sermon, is a confirmation again of this idea about the proper relationship and understanding of the domain of God versus the domain of man, even with the temple. Acts 7, verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he hath appointed, speaking unto Moses, that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen. So Moses absolutely followed the instruction and did everything God told him to do. Verse 45, which also our fathers that came after brought in with Jesus into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the faces of our fathers unto the days of David. We saw some of those at the very beginning of this message where we talk about the inhabitants of the land that God dispossessed and gave over to new rightful inhabitors, the Israelites, in that land of Canaan. Verse 46, who found favor before God and desired to find a tabernacle for the God of Jacob, rehearsing this story of David. David was the one who found favor before God and desired to find a tabernacle for the God of Jacob. But Solomon built him a house. Solomon's the one that God actually allowed to complete the project, even though it was conceived in the mind of David. Verse 48, howbeit the Most High dwells not in temples made with hands. As saith the prophet, we already read this in Isaiah, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. What house will you build me, saith the Lord? Or what is the place of my rest? Hath not my hand made all these things? Lest human beings get out of their lane and misinterpret their relationship with this God, who truly is the creator of all that exists in heaven and earth. We can't build God a house. He can allow a house to be built as a symbol for his throne in heaven, which he did, but it is not truly the domain of God. When God is there, and it is called the house of God, but we need to understand that it is not like the pagan gods who are assumed to live and do all of their work out of this one spot, and so they put food in there and sacrifices and all this in order to feed and provide a livelihood for their God. That's how limiting, even in their own ideas, are their gods compared to our God who fills heaven and earth. So when we're talking about an habitat for God, there is no limit because he inhabits all space in the universe and beyond time. Yes, God views his place of habitation very differently than human beings do. Last text today, back to Psalm 132 again. Now verse 12 through 14 of Psalm 132. If thy children will keep my covenant and my testimony that I shall teach them, their children shall also sit upon thy throne forevermore. For the Eternal hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. How, in this case, then, is God defining a habitat? A habitation, a place to live, a place to remain, a place to settle, a place to dwell, a place to live. Most of all, he's not talking about a physical place. He's talking about a union, a communion with other beings whom he loves. In other words, home is where the heart is another way of saying it. It's about where his devoted children are who love him and who have shown that they love him by their use of the Spirit in order to put on the very mind of God, and that's where he wants to be. He can be and is everywhere in the universe. There is no limit to this God physically. But where he talks about having his place of dwelling, where he lives, where he wants to be, most of all, is in a place where he shares a habitat with his beloved children who love him and are loved in return. He hath desired it for his habitation. Verse 14, this is my rest forever, he says. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it. So this is just an introduction. This whole idea about a habitat for God and man. And we're going to explore other aspects of this throughout the Bible, hopefully in a way maybe that you haven't seen. Again, nothing new, nothing phenomenal, except from the perspective, I think there's a lot that can really add depth to all of that is already a part of the faith once delivered that we understand technically. So in this series, we're going to examine more about the significance of having a place to dwell and what all is involved in these different habitats, both for God and for man.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the first message in a new series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, December 23rd, 2023.